today for a conversation with a Swami. And we're very, very lucky to have His Holiness Bhaktivedanta Swami here with us today. I would usually speak a little bit more, but I'm going to get straight into it. I want to start off with understanding what's going on in the world today, the world that we live in. And that basically looks at the news that's been going on in the world. I think every day when we wake up, there's always something different going on. Whether that's an attack, or the political elections, or so many different things that are going on. In London, in the UK alone, in the last 4 months, there's been an attack in Westminster, an attack in London Bridge, the London fire, the Manchester attack, and the Finsbury attack at the mosque just last week. So we kind of see that we're living in a world right now which has many, many problems, like the sound. And because of that, I have twofold questions, basically. There's two-part questions. It's not working. So it's not working.
Testing.
Hello.
Just hold the lead.
That's right. Is that better?
Yeah.
A lot better. So, now we've kind of set the scene. I'll speak a little bit quieter, save my voice. But the first thing I want to understand is just from a Krishna conscious perspective, we see all these tragedies
happening,
all these attacks happening, this fire that happened.
And
I want to understand two things. The first thing I want to understand is, how do you explain this level of suffering? That's the first part I want to understand. How do you explain an innocent person who had come here for a holiday and was just sightseeing on a bridge, taking some pictures, and it got run over? How do you explain a poor innocent young girl who was probably asleep in her bedroom, who got burnt alive tragically? How can we explain these things that we see all the time? And I was speaking to my friend actually before the fire happened, and the London Bridge attack had just happened, and we were saying, what's going on in this world? And my friend said, actually, there'll probably be something else next week. And the next week was when the Grenfell Tower fire happened. And we see it's a recurring theme now. So the first thing is, how do we experience the level of suffering? And the second question, or the second part, is actually understanding that how can we try and deal with these situations that happen? How can we deal with them on an emotional front, on a spiritual front, and more importantly, how do you deal with it on a practical front? So if you could share some insights on that to begin with. Sorry for the lonely question to start off, but good idea.
That's great.
Thank you,
Sheikh. Well, let's begin with a historical view of the world. And then it flows into the philosophical understanding. First and foremost, however unfortunate, tragic, and reprehensible some of these events may be, and they indeed are, the point to note is that it's not something unusual for this world, and it never has been. The history of this world has always been one of turbulence, violence, cruelty, catastrophes, unfortunate and tragic events, and so on. So it's not something that is new. It's not something that is peculiar only to our day and age. The difference may be that in the past, the tragedies happened in one way. The instruments may have been slightly different. But other than that, the difference is not really substantial. Maybe in the early days they didn't have guns and bombs, but they had swords and other things with which to wreak havoc. Today they have guns and bombs, and they do many things with cars. But the principle is the same, that this world has been a violent and cruel place from time immemorial, and that's nothing new at all. So that's the history of it. Now, looking at it from a philosophical point of view, the same thing is also confirmed by Lord Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, when he declares this place to be a place of trouble, of suffering, and a temporary place, dukkhalayam ashashvatam. It is the abode of misery and suffering. So one could say that this place has been programmed for pain and suffering. So that's the philosophical reason behind these events happening. But why they happen? Well, actually, here we have to, before we get into why it happens, let's say that regardless of why it happens, we do have to commiserate with the victims of such tragic and unfortunate events. We cannot justify or explain away the sufferings and pains of such a large number of people, or even a small number of people, simply on philosophical grounds. We definitely sympathize with them, our hearts reach out to them in the time of pain and suffering. And yet, human society is known for its intelligence, for its ability to analyze and understand situations, and not just the what and how, but also the why. So if we explore philosophically on the basis of the Bhagavad Gita, we can understand that these catastrophes happen because of individually and collectively performed bad activities. And they have a reaction. This is called the law of karma. So these reactions sometimes come to us at an individual level, and sometimes they come to us at a group level or a social level, at a global level. So suffering and happiness both come back to us. So it's a big topic, but suffice it to say that we do sympathize and we don't condone any willing performance of such cruel acts. At the same time, there are many acts that happen by nature's arrangement. And we should know that even though we can't blame any specific individuals for it, but by and large, human society has been indulging in so much of violence and cruelty that these things are the natural reaction to that. So we will not get into specific events, but this is the broad general principle behind what we are seeing today.
Touching on the second point, how does the application of our Krishna consciousness and a spiritual lifestyle help us deal with it?
For one thing, you know, Krishna consciousness gives you a cool head. So you don't get so hot-headed as to blow up things and drive cars into people and so on. So it gives you a sober head. It gives you a clear understanding of what the goal of life is. It charts out a whole program of action for life. It gives us a lifestyle which we should be leading, which leads eventually to peaceful, happy coexistence amongst different classes of people, despite there being differences of opinion, differences of beliefs in people. So Krishna consciousness can actually be like a panacea, it can be like a one switch that will turn on light in this whole world, the light of knowledge and love. At the same time, we do understand that it may be an idealistic prescription and that there are a large number of people who may not and will not take to this process. So then we just have to have proper arrangements on the material platform by which such things may be prevented. But that's hard, because a determined individual or a group of individuals can always wreak havoc when they wish, despite our best efforts to prevent such events from happening. So ultimately, there is no solution to the spreading of spiritual knowledge and to the idea that we have to love the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. when our hearts will overflow with love, there will be no place left for hatred and anger and cruelty and violence. That is at the heart of the whole situation. Maybe we can exchange, we can go to this.
I think there's a cordless mic somewhere. Is there? I think it's okay, you speak, that's why the sound system is running like that. So am I correct in understanding that, my understanding is that we're living in Kali Yuga right now. So is my understanding correct in presuming that things are only going to get worse from here? And if so, what's the extent that we can, how far will it go?
Yes, you're right, this is Kali Yuga and things will get worse, but there's a silver lining to this cloud, and that is this Krishna consciousness movement. When the process of Krishna consciousness is adopted by more and more people, and indeed it's happening now, then we will see eventually in course of time the dawn of a golden age, even in this Kali Yuga, which is the age of Kauravas. So really what we need to do, and this is the prime requirement for this age, it's an emergency. We have to practice Krishna consciousness very seriously, and we have to spread it as much as we can by appealing to the higher instincts and intelligence of people.
So I think that was a good answer and summation to the tragedies that are going on. And now touching more upon this concept of Krishna consciousness, would you be kind enough to elaborate, or maybe without elaborate, maybe succinctly give us a synopsis of what Krishna consciousness is, the basics. I think you've given an elevator pitch kind of style of what is Krishna consciousness, from the most fundamental principles of what we need to know, what's the goal of Krishna consciousness, and what is Krishna consciousness?
Krishna consciousness, in very brief, means to be conscious of Krishna with love. In other words, to love Krishna. And to give a little a more elaborate explanation, it is to understand that we are not this body. We are not to be divided on the basis of caste, creed, community, and so on and so forth, but we are ultimately the spirit soul. We are eternal spiritual entities, and we have an eternal relationship of love with the supreme spiritual entity, the personality of Godhead, Krishna, the all-attractive one. And to revive that relationship of love, which we have forgotten, is the ultimate goal and perfection of our life. Make sense?
Yes.
This is what happens, so great.
We'll try. So leading on from that, Krishna consciousness, to be conscious of Krishna with love.
Yes.
So I'm guessing by saying Krishna consciousness, it's obvious that what's in focus is Krishna. But I kind of see there's some inconsistency when it comes to the Vedic culture. If you go to Ealing Road today, maybe not today, at some point, if you go to Ealing Road and you ask 10 people in the space of 2 minutes, who is God? One will give you an answer, Shiva is God, one will say Ganesh is God, one will say Vishnu is God. And by saying Krishna consciousness, you're implying Krishna is God. Whereas if you look at religions like Islam, for example, you ask any Muslim who is God, they know Allah is the answer. There's no inconsistency. It's not, there's this form of Allah, there's this form of Allah. So how do you explain, can you shed some light on this inconsistency that we see in Vedic culture regarding who is God?
Well, actually, you see, what is popularly known as Hinduism is not one religion as people understand the term. and as existing religions in the world today. But Hinduism is more like a broad civilization. It's a civilization that is part of the Vedic culture. It is a civilization that has many strands, but they all have a fundamental underlying unity. They have some common points. For example, they all accept the Veda, the original source of all knowledge. They accept scriptures like the Bhagavad Gita. And there are many other spiritual, religious and cultural facets which are accepted by all these different groups. However, when it comes to theology and accepting a particular divinity as a supreme, there may be some differences, and there indeed are. And that is because Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is very mindful of the fact that people have different mentalities. And you can't paint everyone with one brush. You can't put everyone into one corner. Somebody wants worship in the mode of ignorance. Somebody wants one kind of worship. Somebody wants another kind of worship. According to the mentalities, what Krishna has offered to the people of this world, especially within the Vedic culture, various options that appeal to them. And then they accept these modes of worship and these beliefs. And naturally, as they continue on, then they gain faith in that particular process. And in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that that faith that these worshippers of different divinities have is also provided by Him. It's coming from Him within the heart of that particular worshipper, because that worshipper wants to worship in a certain way. So those other forms of worship are considered by Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita to be indirect forms of worship. But Krishna says, we need not worship Him indirectly, we should worship Him directly by surrendering to Him and taking guidance from the devotees. So when we see from the point of view of Krishna consciousness, this harmonizes everything. And Lord Krishna is like the root of the entire creation. Just as when you water the root of a tree, the entire tree gets watered and nourished. The branches, the leaves, the twigs and so on. Similarly, when we worship Krishna, then all the other divinities in the Vedic pantheon, they automatically get satisfied. So this is how we understand it. We do not disrespect or criticize other divinities, and that is certainly wrong to do, because they are empowered personalities nominated by the Supreme Lord Krishna Himself. But we do understand from Bhagavad Gita that to consider them to be independent and supreme is not correct. The word Bhagavad Gita itself means the song of God. And since Krishna is the speaker of the Bhagavad Gita, even before we read the text, we understand that Krishna is God. So we accept Krishna is God because the scripture Bhagavad Gita declares Him to be so.
So leading on from that, there's this understanding that that Krishna comes from Vishnu. So is there a supremacy of Vishnu over Krishna? How does that relationship work?
Yes, the relationship between Krishna and Vishnu is a matter of much discussion and debate amongst those who accept the Vedic culture. Actually, there is no difference between Krishna and Vishnu. He is the same one transcendental supreme personality. However, there is a difference in the mode. Let me give a very simple example to illustrate this. Let's say there's a gentleman who is a judge in the court and he also is a member of some social organizations. He's also a sportsman on the side. So he wears many hats, so to speak. And when he's at home, he wears one kind of set of clothes. He acts in a certain way. When he's in the court, he's naturally very formal. He dresses in a certain way, he speaks in a certain way, when he's playing football or cricket, which is his passion, he dresses in yet another way, acts in another way. When he's at a social gathering, let's say somebody's wedding or something, he's dressed again differently. He's one same person, but he acts, speaks, and dresses and behaves differently in all these situations. And if you look at him in one of them, you may think, wow, he's such a different person. You look at him in the court and he's stern, strict, formal. And when you go home, he's smiling, very gentle, very nice, and you say, this is a different person. Well, in a sense, he's a different person. But actually, he's the same person. So similarly, Krishna and Vishnu are one and the same person. But Vishnu is the more formal aspect of Krishna. You can say that the world, the material world, is like an office space, right? And when Krishna comes here to take care of the material creation, to generate the universe, to maintain it, then he takes the official form of Vishnu. But when Krishna is in his own home in Vrindavan, then he's very informal. Then he's playing the flute, he herds the cows, he has Rasalila with the gopis. So that's the simultaneous oneness and difference between Krishna and Vishnu.
Is there a sort of chronology, as in who comes from whom?
Yes, indeed. Let's look at the High Court judge again. Which is the original person? Who is the original person? If you want to know the person really well, where would you like to know him? You'd like to know him at the formal social function or at the court? Where is the place where you'd like to know him in the most intimate way? At home. That's where you really get to know him as a person. There he has no defenses. But in the court, he's up there. He has to act in a certain way, follow a certain etiquette. So we can understand that because Krishna is living in Vrindavan, he's the most informal, he's present in his most informal way over there. So it stands to reason that he is the origin of all other forms of Godhead. And this has also been mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the great scripture that is a postgraduate study pursuant to the study of the Bhagavad Gita, where it describes that Krishna is the source of all the avatars, including Vishnu.
Thank you. So moving on from more controversial topics of discussion within the Vedic culture, the next sort of topic I will touch on is vegetarianism. And the general... And the general eating of meat in the Vedic culture. I mean, I don't know about a lot of people here, but I grew up with some friends who said, Nana, I eat meat, but not on Tuesdays, because, you know, there's that understanding. Some people have that. And even when I ask them why do they do that, they don't know. They're just parents used to tell them. So what's the sort of understanding of the general concept of vegetarianism in Krishna consciousness? Because right now it seems like a fad or just a cool thing to do, like, oh, I'm vegetarian, I'm vegan, and whatever. So, yeah.
I think it would be a good idea to tell your friend that there are also six other days on which it is good to be vegetarian. It helps. So why are we vegetarian? Because it's just a civilized thing to do. Let me ask a simple question to all of you. You just have to tell me whether you agree or you don't agree. All of you who agree will have to raise your hand. The statement is that a civilized society is one that inflicts minimum possible pain and cruelty for its survival. Agree or disagree? Agree, how many agree? Raise your hand. Okay, how many disagree? How many are indifferent, neutral? You're not sure. Okay, mostly everybody agrees. So if you agree that a civilized society is one that causes minimum possible pain and cruelty, then how would you justify killing animals for food when we could well do without meat? We have plenty of grains and fruits and vegetables and such products available, which are quite nourishing, nutritious. They are capable of supplying us with all our nutritional requirements. They're quite tasty. It doesn't cause the kind of vile or pain and cruelty that eating meat involves. So how can we, from a moral point of view, from an ethical point of view, justify killing animals when plenty of vegetarian food is available? So it's just a matter of common sense as I can see it. Leave aside, let's keep out God from the picture, let's leave out religion from the picture for the time being. Let's just talk of basic human decency, basic human values. Why should we cause unnecessary pain to others? Especially when there are so many options available which are completely wholesome. Of course, the topic of vegetarianism is a big one. But this one thing, this one point, I think, is the simplest and most telling point in favor of vegetarianism.
Leading on from that, what about the concept of plants being living things also? Isn't that inflicting violence?
Yes, indeed, it is. And therefore I said minimum possible violence and cruelty. It is not possible in this world to exist without causing some pain to other living entities. In fact, the Vedic scriptures say jiva jivasya jivanam, that one living entity is food for another living entity. So our designated food as human beings is vegetarian food. So yes, we do cause some violence and pain to plants, but mind you, not all vegetarian food involves killing, because there's milk, and if you make sure that the calf is treated well, the cow is treated well, the calf gets its share of the milk, and if you're taking such milk, it's very wholesome. It doesn't involve killing. The modern dairy industry involves killing, but if you do it with protecting cows, it doesn't involve killing. Fruits don't involve killing. There are many nuts don't involve killing. But yes, grains and certain other kinds of plants involve killing. But the kind of violence and pain that is caused is immeasurably lower for plants than it is for animals. Therefore, I said, we take the route that causes minimum possible pain. And one more thing is necessary to mention at this point, that we also understand, as you have rightly said, the limitations of vegetarianism. Therefore, we follow the instructions of Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, and we offer vegetarian food to Krishna. He kindly accepts it, and then it becomes sanctified holy food, which is called prasadam. So we don't really pride ourselves on being vegetarians, but rather we identify ourselves as being prasaditarians. So that's much better than being a vegetarian. Of course, being a vegetarian is much better than being a non-vegetarian, but being a prasaditarian is the best of all.
So leading on from prasaditarian, which is my new favorite term, why does Krishna not like onion and garlic? So, leading off from that, adding some context around it, there are so many times where I've had to tell people that I don't eat onion garlic, or some of the devotees tell me they don't eat onion garlic. And the sort of response is always like, it's a bit passionate, it's in this sort of, it makes your head feel a bit weird, which I'm not sure it makes sense so much. But there's always these excuses. So what is the ideology behind onion and garlic?
I'll give you one answer. Just be next to a person who's eating onion and garlic. And I think you've got your answer. You see, a thing is identified by its smell. This is one of the very important characteristics of understanding the worth or the qualities of any object. So look at onion and garlic. What kind of smell do they have? So we understand from the pungency of the smell that these items are not really good to eat because they're not going to be conducive to the development of our spiritual consciousness. Apart from the smell, which is indicative of its inherent nature, we understand that different kinds of foods have different kinds of impacts on our consciousness. You've heard the phrase, you are what you eat. So when you eat foods that are pure vegetarian, then you get a very pure consciousness. When you eat foods that are products of violence, that also breeds a violent mentality. I think it was Pythagoras, the ancient Greek philosopher and scientist, who once said that for a person who sees nothing objectionable in killing animals, soon he will not see anything objectionable in killing humans. And that is why we see that people are just taking the widespread deaths of people today so casually, because it's just part of life, and many people don't have compunctions in killing. So onion and garlic are foods that are the perfect companions to non-vegetarian food. And that's why you can see they share the qualities of non-vegetarian food. So partaking of such food will be not helpful for the consciousness of somebody who wants to be peaceful and happy, and particularly to one who wants to progress in spiritual life.
Yeah, I agree with the smell. So leading on from that, my question now turns towards alcohol.
Alcohol. Well, not much different. Alcohol and alcohol.
Drinking in general. So I understand the concept of you shouldn't get too drunk, or you shouldn't drink so much because then you start losing your head, you do stupid things, which I think a lot of people know they've seen happen or done themselves. And you know, you lose your mind a little bit, you can't really control yourself. So that concept of drinking is bad for you, makes sense, because it's quite intoxicating. But now myself working in a corporate environment where almost every day everyone's always like, coming out for a drink, Abby? And I'm like, no. They're like, why? I was like, I don't drink. And they always say, just try a little bit, you know, just a little sip. And it kind of makes me think, okay, the consumption of alcohol in moderation, you know. I mean, I think there's some new health studies that have come out that say that if you drink wine a little bit a day, that's actually quite good for your health because it thins your blood. So, I mean, drinking too much makes sense, but drinking, like, socially, what's your perspective on that? And as I understand it, like, in Vedic cultural times, you know, there'd be so many kings that would be drinking these sorts of beverages and serving it to their guests. So is that a sort of contradiction of not drinking?
Well, first of all, let's start being kings and then we can whether we can do it or not. But the idea that what's the harm in doing just a little bit in moderation, we won't do it too much. First of all, if I were to say, this is poison, just take a little bit of poison. I'm not saying you should take enough to kill yourself, but just a little bit. What would your argument be? Your argument would be, well, it's poison. And poison is harmful. So even if it is in small quantities, why should I take it? Because I mean well for myself, I want to protect my interests. I don't want to cause myself harm. So that's the first point. And secondly, most people who start drinking start like this. Just a little bit. Just a little bit. And then a little bit becomes a little more. And a little more. And then it becomes a habit. And then there's no saying when it goes beyond. So when something is not good, why should we do it? When something is harmful, why should we do it? As far as what modern research shows, you know, these things change every single day. One day they say this product causes this cancer, the other day it says no it doesn't, it's actually helpful, the third day this is something else. So we don't rely on this ever-changing understanding of what's good for us. We'd rather rely on the knowledge that is given to us by the ancient sages and by the Supreme Lord Himself, that tells us of what kind of food is good for us and what is not good for us. First of all, we need to know what the purpose of food is. The purpose of food is to aid bodily strength, to give nourishment, to feed or to satiate the hunger, but above all, it's there to purify the consciousness. So we only consider taste, or another aspect is the taste of food. We consider only these aspects of taste and whether it fills our belly, but very rarely do we consider this one very important aspect of food and drink, which is, what is the impact on the consciousness? If a particular food or drink can purify our consciousness, then we are all for it. But if it is not going to do that, then we avoid it. Whether we take it in small quantity or moderate quantity. Right? So I suggest you still continue to not join them when they go to the park.
Yeah, definitely. So it seems like we're now going through all these rules and regulations. Yes. It kind of now seems like Krishna consciousness is a sort of dogmatic sort of system where you kind of just follow all these rules and you kind of just think that, okay, I'm becoming a better person or I'm becoming closer to Krishna, like that. But how do you not know if it's just the effect of following all these rules that we're kind of just saying to ourselves that actually, no, it's actually making a difference in my life?
Isn't football exactly like that? So many rules, so many regulations. Every few moments the referee blows a whistle and shows this card or that card and then stops the game and it starts again. What fun it would be if there were no rules in football. If everyone just got on the field and there was a nice free-for-all and they just went for it, what would happen? A lot of fun, isn't it? Yes, but there would also be a lot of problem. What about driving a car? So many rules and regulations. Such a botheration. Wouldn't it be fun if there were no signals? There was no traffic rules about signaling before you turn left and right and lanes and so much botheration. What about our studies? If it was so nice if universities had no classes and no exams and rules to follow, right? So everything in life has rules and regulations. Any civilized society or any civilized activity must have some decorum, it must have some etiquette, it must be bound by some rules and regulations. It's fine to have freedom, but that freedom must be circumscribed by certain rules and regulations. And so is Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness is actually the original loving energy of the spirit soul that is directed to Krishna. But at this moment, this original loving energy is forgotten. It has been suppressed. It is covered over by our ignorance. So in order that this covering of ignorance be removed and the original loving energy of our Krishna consciousness emerge, we have to follow rules and regulations. And another analogy I can give you in this connection is that of going to a doctor when we are sick. And assume that we are really sick and we have a major illness and the doctor gives us a series of do's and don'ts. And we grumble a lot, but we follow it, right? We understand the necessity of it. The doctor says, you know, so many things, do this, do that. It's such a botheration. But we do it because we understand why we do it, why it's helpful for us to follow these rules and how it will be harmful for us if we don't follow these rules. So from a spiritual point of view, a person who is in materialistic consciousness is diseased. And therefore the spiritual master is like a doctor who gives us prescriptions, who gives us do's and don'ts. So in the initial stages of Krishna consciousness, we do follow these rules and regulations scrupulously. However, when one becomes a very elevated soul, when one's spontaneous and natural devotion for Krishna has emerged, then one is not obliged to follow so many rules and regulations. But nevertheless, such an exalted soul will still follow them, just to set the proper example. Otherwise, people would imitate him, those who are not as qualified as him, and then there would be havoc in the society. So we have to see the following of rules and regulations in this context.
So maybe this is an immature way of thinking about it, but why can't Krishna just see that we're struggling with the rules and regulations that make it easy for us? Because a lot of times, you know, some people actually try to follow the rules, but they just can't. So why is Krishna so unfair?
Why is the doctor so cruel to us? Right? Why does the doctor not understand? Just let me drink a little alcohol, what's the problem? Let me drink or eat a little sweet even if I have high diabetes. Why is he so cruel? Because the doctor means well for us. He understands what our ailment is. He has diagnosed the problem. He has the therapy or the treatment available. And now the ball is in our court, so to speak. So we could complain about how the doctor is cruel and unfair, but the point is that it will be helpful for us to do it. And it is our fault that we got into this problem. We created a lifestyle problem. We got some sickness. Now we can't blame the doctor. So similarly, we are here in this material world in forgetfulness of Krishna because we wanted to enjoy separately from him. So now the ball is in our court. Krishna has given us a prescription. It's up to us whether we want to accept it or not. Yes?
Yes. So just conscious of time now, because we wanted to leave a lot of time for Q&A. I want to get into more specific questions regarding Krishna. So the first question that I want to understand is, why does Krishna favor cows?
Cows?
Cows. So why is there, you see in Krishna consciousness, everyone really emphasizes cow protection, you know, you have a Goshala here, which is incredible, they take care of the cows really well, but why is it not just like a farm with lots of animals, and why don't we emphasize loads of animals?
Why don't we have?
Yeah, why don't we have so many more animals that we favor, as opposed to just...
Certainly, as devotees, we don't want to cause pain to any living entity, so why should we harm any animals? And we're all for the cause of protecting animals. However, even amongst animals, there are those that are considered at a certain higher level because of their qualities. The cow is very dear to Lord Krishna. In fact, you can know that from his names, Gopal, one who is a protector of cows, or Govinda, one who gives pleasure to the cows. His abode is called Goloka or Gokul, that means the abode of cows. His favorite hill is Govardhan, that which enhances the welfare of the cows. So everything about Krishna is connected to cows. Because a cow is such an offenseless creature. The cow provides us milk. And that milk is the next best substitute to mother's milk for us as humans. The milk of the cow is extremely pure. I mean, when the cow is looked after with love and devotion, not as is done in the modern day slaughterhouse dairies. But traditionally, when these cows are looked after with love and devotion, they're not sent to the slaughterhouse, the calves get enough milk to drink and so on, then such milk is extremely nourishing, not just for the body, not just for the brain, but also for our spiritual inclinations. So it is said in the Vedic scriptures that foods in the mode of goodness, and particularly foods like milk and so on, they nurture and foster the spirituality that is dormant within us. They make us more inclined to spiritual life. And since the cow provides us with this milk, therefore we revere the cow. She is considered the mother. And the bull is also like the father because it ploughs our fields. He provides us the grains. So the cow is mother and the bull is father. So we protect them, look after them and serve them.
So another question I had regarding Krishna was, we understand, we hear that Krishna had 16,108 wives. Most people struggle to have one. But Krishna had 16,108. So could you explain a little bit more about this concept of polygamy, and is it allowed in this day and age for us?
I will not question your motives in asking this question. But I will take it as a philosophical question.
Hypothetically, yeah.
You know, Krishna having 16,108 queens, first and foremost, isn't that proof that he is God? I mean, 16,108 queens, and remember, he had one palace for each of them. And each of those palaces was so gorgeous and wonderful that Buckingham Palace would have seemed like a little small cottage, small little house or hut in front of those palaces. And he maintained each and every one of those 16,108 queens, and they were fully satisfied. And what's more, he was present with every one of those queens at the same time. So it's not that when he was with one queen, he was not with another queen, and she was feeling, why is Krishna not with me? So he was present with all the queens at the very same moment, at the same time. So that all the queens were completely satisfied and happy with Krishna. So, of course, it's a big topic. But the point is that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and everything in existence represents his energies. So these queens are not ordinary ladies of this world. They are his internal spiritual energies. So Krishna is actually reciprocating the love of his internal energy with his devotees. That is how we understand it. And of course, many of these queens who were rescued by Krishna, 16,108 of them, they were imprisoned by a cruel tyrant. And they begged for being rescued, and nobody else would marry them. So Krishna is the ultimate transcendental hero, and he stepped into the scene and rescued them and married them all. So he is the ultimate hero. Our movie heroes and so on are just very dim reflections of the one ultimate hero. But as far as polygamy is concerned, in this day and age, in Kali Yuga, it is not recommended. In those days, yes, it was a standard practice, especially among kings and also among some others. The idea being that Kshatriyas, you know, would go out into battle and they would die in large numbers. And then the number of ladies would be much higher than the number of men. So it was just basic demographics in those days. So this was the custom in those days, but now it's not recommended. In Kali Yuga, Lord Ramachandra and Treta Yuga also set the standard of Ek Patni Vrata. He had only one wife. So that is the recommended process for this age.
So, I completely agree with everything you're saying, but if someone comes to me with this fact, which they somehow found out, and if I start explaining this to them,
who's got no background in Christian consciousness whatsoever, or even knows anything about the Vedic culture, and I start explaining about this, they look at me as if I said the most stupidest thing in the world. Because actually, when you think about it from an outsider's perspective, a lot of Christians' pastimes in general seem very, very mythological, like a little boy carrying Govardhan Hill with a little finger, having 16,108 wives. So how do you kind of, now flip side, saying that, okay, we understand that this is all true, how do we now try and explain it to others?
You see, before we try to understand somebody's activities, we must try to understand who he is. Then the activities automatically fall into place. You know, sometimes you have very important people, let's say the president of a country or something, and he's going to an airport and everybody is, you know, sort of aside, and there's a special entry for him, and they say, why should he get a special line? But the point is that he's the president of the country or something like that. So when one understands he's the president, then automatically one doesn't question, you know, his activities. So similarly, people try to understand Krishna's activities before they can understand who he is and what his position is and what it means to be in that position. Lord Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is the origin of everything. By everything, I mean everything. There's nothing that doesn't emanate from him. Everything is his property. It is his energy. And nothing can happen without his sanction. That is what it means to be God. So when we understand what it means to be God, the lifting of a hill is an insignificant activity for him. When he is balancing billions of universes, and within each universe there are billions of planets that are floating in, around and moving in their orbits perfectly, then just lifting one hill is nothing really miraculous. But it seems so because we judge his actions with respect to our powers and abilities. And therefore we think, oh, how is it possible someone can lift a mountain or a hill? Because we don't understand what it means to be God and what kind of powers God has. So I would suggest that when your friends ask these questions, you can explain it this way and try to make them understand what God means, what God is, and who God is. And then we can try to understand the activities of God.
Thank you very much. Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Sanjay, thank you for giving some incredible answers. At this point, I want to open out to the crowd. You look very enthusiastic to ask questions. So please have a think. Your questions can be related to anything that was mentioned today, or probably anything in the world, because I think Maharaj can answer them. And as you ponder on the questions, just to close off, Maharaj, if you'd like to give us all your top three tips of living peacefully in this world of chaos. So if you were to give someone asks you, what are the top three tips of Krishna consciousness that you can give us, what would they be? And that way you can all think of your questions.
Associate regularly with sincere devotees of Krishna. Read the Srimad Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam regularly, sincerely, and chant Hare Krishna. Three tips.
So now, question time. Yeah, straight away.
Actually, the dharma which is followed by Lord Ram is completely different from the dharma which is followed by Lord Krishna in Mahabharata during the battle. Why is it like that? Actually, Lord Ram said to follow this kshatriya dharma while killing anyone. Like, by killing Ravana, he even gave him a chance to live before killing him directly. So he followed the kshatriya dharma. But whereas, in terms of Lord Krishna, he said, Arjuna to kill Dronacharya, but during Ashwatthama Kunjana. So, according to Kshatriya Dharma, what Ram said, and in terms of Kshatriya Dharma, which Krishna said, it's a bit different. So, how can we justify that?
We must remember that Lord Ram also killed Vali from behind. Yes? Was that according to Kshatriya Dharma?
Yeah, but actually...
Yes, it was. Yeah. I mean, when Vali protested, Ram explained how it was indeed not against Kshatriya Dharma. But the important thing is, what Ram said at that time to Vali is very significant. When Vali protested that how could you first of all shoot at me when I have no enmity with you, number one. And number two, how could you fight with me as a Kshatriya and kill me from behind, which is most abominable for a Kshatriya to do. And Lord Ram replied, you are speaking of dharma, but what happened to your dharma when you kidnapped your brother's wife, when he usurped his kingdom and so on. So he gave many examples. He also explained about human beings and animals. We leave that aside for the time being. So the point is that Ram is also God. So he is the dispenser of justice, ultimately. And sometimes justice may be dispensed impersonally through the medium of the laws of nature, which are in any case controlled by God. And sometimes God may personally come to dispense justice, which Lord Ram did in the case of Ali. Similarly, even though by and large what you say is right, Lord Ram was what is known as the Maryada Purushottam, the paragon of virtue and proper etiquette in doing everything. The ideal human, the ideal son, the ideal king, and so on. But ultimately, he is the Supreme Lord. The Supreme Lord is not a Kshatriya or a Vaishya or anything. The Supreme Lord is always a Supreme Lord. And this is what we remember when we think about Krishna. That even though Krishna was playing the role of a Kshatriya, but we must remember that he was never limited by that role. It was only a role. And ultimately he remains the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and as the Lord, he has many objectives to fulfill through his actions. His primary goal was to establish the rule of dharma on the planet. And he wanted to use Maharaj Yudhishthira as the person who would execute that. And he wanted to use his devotees like Arjuna as his instruments. So therefore, in the effort to do that, he did certain things which are controversial, which are not understood clearly by people. But as devotees, we understand that ultimately Krishna was playing the role of the Lord at those moments. For example, when it came to killing or lying or certain things, he said, well, the point was that those people who were killed in that fashion, had themselves performed violations of dharma. For example, Abhimanyu was killed unfairly. According to the codes of Kshatriya warfare, equals fight equals. But here Abhimanyu was surrounded by six people who were superior to him, and then he was killed. So everybody who was involved in that killing was also liable to be killed exactly against the principles of dharma, as indeed they had done to somebody else. And therefore Krishna in these times, in these incidents, was actually simply giving them what they deserved according to the law of karma. It just so happened that he became the direct instrument for that, being physically and personally present there. But otherwise, impersonally, it would have happened through the agency of the laws of nature. So when we understand Krishna's position, when we understand that Krishna had a plan, then all of these controversial events, they fall into place. Okay? Yes.
My question is, as you say, your second response, that Krishna consciousness gives us cool head and does not give hot head to do bad deeds. But does this lifestyle of coexistence as given the rest of the society has been ours? Do you think it's a time for reaction, or we can pass the correct message? How can we pass the correct message? That's my first question.
Okay, we'll deal with the first question first. So your question is that if we have a cool head, will that be taken as a sign of cowardice?
Yes.
Indeed, no. A cool head doesn't mean that you're weak. A cool head doesn't mean that you're a coward. A cool head, it only means that you're cool when you should be cool. A hot head is hot even when one should be cool. The problems in the world will come about because of a lot of hot heads, right? So, one time actually, Srila Prabhupada was in America, our founder Acharya, and a press reporter came to see him, and she was a lady, and she was interviewing him. And she asked him many questions, and he answered them all very emphatically, very clearly. And she had no question left. She had come in a somewhat argumentative mood, but she had nothing left to ask because every question was answered so nicely. Then finally, she had only one weapon left. And she let loose and she said, but then why do you people shave your head? Right? So he said, for a cool head. And then he replied, because the lady was wearing a very short miniskirt. So he said, better we have warm legs and cool head than cool legs and a hot head. So a cool head is very necessary for the functioning of a civilized society. But a cool head will also make adequate arrangements for defense, for protection from unruly and unethical elements. Okay?
And if we can just give other people a chance as well, kindly. So I think there's another question there.
There's nothing much is regarding anyone, so we can give you a chance.
Yeah, last thing. Samuel, you talked about non-vegetarian, we lead to violence. Yeah? And India has become non-violent. I mean, India was a vegetarian for a long time, thousands of years. And same period, India was occupied first by Muslims, then by Britishers. So do you see any relationship between India becoming vegetarian and India become occupied by foreign forces?
No. No relation. The relation, if anything, is that India started progressively losing its spiritual heritage and culture. And India started becoming more and more materialistic. But being vegetarian doesn't imply a sign of weakness. The elephant is also vegetarian. Yes? So no, there's no connection.
I think there's a question.
Maharaj, thank you so much. My question is that even though I'm finding the process of Krishna consciousness very wonderful, sometimes with the family members we find that there's a response which says, don't go too deep, or don't practice too much, you know, we still have to go to work, we still have to do all these kinds of things. So what would be an ideal response to such individuals, especially when they're family, because we have to be sensitive a little bit, because ultimately they've seen us grow up from children. So when they see us grow up like that, when we're trying to give high philosophical answers, sometimes they may not understand, or they may not take it seriously, per se. So what would be your response to, specifically to family members who are saying about this?
One should allay their fears by gently explaining that becoming more serious in Krishna consciousness will not result in irresponsible behavior on our part, and that we will not cease to perform our duties in this world properly. And when they see that happening, when they see us doing what we're supposed to do in life, in addition to our direct Krishna conscious activities, then their concerns will be addressed. Right?
Any other questions?
I can see hands shooting us.
Say something about some alcoholism. Yes, the quantity is responsible for Ireland or non-Ireland. But it's a question of sin and non-sin. Even a drop of alcohol, it contaminates like a poison to the brain center, and it destroys the spirituality.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any more questions?
Yes.
Yeah. One here.
So my question was in relation to vegetarianism. You said the purpose was to cause minimum pain.
Yeah.
And I'm a vegetarian.
One of the main reasons for the main, very important
reason. Yeah, so the main reason was that. So what would you say to someone who says an animal has a soul and a plant also has a soul? So how can we justify the difference where one is suffering more pain than the other? Because we're all souls.
That's because of the difference in the development of the body. The plant body and the animal body are differently structured and differently designed. You see, the capacity of the plant to feel pain is very low compared to that of an animal. To speak in terms of biology, you see, the more advanced the nervous system of a living being, the more sensitivity it has to pain and pleasure. So the nervous system is the most developed in human beings. So we're extremely sensitive. The animals, less so, but much more compared to the lower living entities and ultimately the plants. So therefore, because the development of the nervous system in plants is practically nil, all the plants also do feel, but it is very, very microscopic or infinitesimal compared to that of animals, what to speak of humans. Therefore, the quantum of pain that we cause is much lesser. Very, very small in comparison to that of animals. Although, as I said, there is some sin involved in killing plants. We try to avoid unnecessary killing of plants and trees and so on. Okay?
I think we have another question over here.
Out-of-body experiences.
Out-of-body experience, okay. An out-of-body experience is when the subtle body leaves the gross body for a while and then eventually re-enters the body. According to Bhagavad Gita, we are told of three categories. One is the gross body, which is our physical body, the bones, the flesh, the blood, and the organs. The second is the subtle body, which consists of the mind, the intelligence, the ego, false ego. Both these are material. And ultimately, there's the soul, who is the real I and the real you. So the soul is the one that drives the subtle and the material bodies. When death comes, the subtle body carries the soul away from one gross body to another. So the gross body remains behind and is destroyed. So in an outer body experience, what happens is, even before death, let's say during sleep or during unconsciousness, during a surgical operation, let us say, the subtle body may leave the gross body and go to some place. And in some cases, like near-death experiences, they would see their own body from a vantage point above, and they would see the surgeons performing the surgery on their own body. These are relatively rare, but not as rare as we might think. So this is also evidence that there is an entity that is separate and distinct from the gross body. Actually, we have experiences, out-of-body experiences, more often than we think. Because every time we dream of something, our subtle body travels there. Prabhupada mentions this one time. So we have experience of these out-of-body situations. But what is more extreme is when it happens at near death. say, like in a traumatic situation, post-accident or post-surgery or something like that. So I hope I have answered your question.
I think there was an enormous follow-up question from here as well.
Sorry?
So there's a follow-up question.
Okay.
They were asking amongst themselves. So where do ghosts fit into Christian consciousness?
Ghosts are subtle bodies without the cross body. When an individual performs a certain kind of very sinful activity, then one of the results of that may be, not necessarily in all cases, but in certain cases, that one is deprived of the opportunity to occupy a gross body. The gross body is necessary as an instrument for the subtle body to fulfill its desires. Because the subtle body is full of desires, but the gross body is the instrument through which these desires are fulfilled. For example, the desire to eat good food is there in the mind, which is a part of the subtle body. But if it's a cause that he can't eat because he doesn't have a physical mouth and physical hands, a physical digestive system and so on. So it is a position of great suffering. Therefore many times ghosts have to occupy some other body, somebody else's body, to try to experience something through the medium of that body. And those who are living in the modes of ignorance, taking drugs and alcohol, living very unclean lives, they are usually the victims of such things. Those who lead pure lives, holy lives, devoted to Lord Krishna, then become immune from such occupation by ghostly beings. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Could you shed some light on breaking bad habits and creating good habits? For example, rising early, meditating every day. Even though we have the desire and we have the right association, we're constantly receiving these instructions, we still don't do them. So if you could shed some light on that, please.
It's very easy to start a bad habit, very difficult to stop a bad habit. It's very difficult to start a good habit, very easy to stop a good habit. Is that too confusing? Right? So once you have a good habit, whatever good habits we have, let's not stop them. Let's continue them. So let's use our energy, our determination to continue with those good habits. And when there is temptation to start a new bad habit, again let's exercise our determination, etc. So what helps? What strengthens our determination to do that? Our intelligence. What strengthens the intelligence? It's knowledge and it's hearing. So when we come to the association of devotees often as we possibly can, and we hear the messages of the scriptures like the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, and we associate with like-minded people who also want to cultivate these good habits and give up the bad ones, then we develop that determination and that inclination to do it. Strength and determination comes in company. So we must stick to the company of those who have these good habits. And we must try equally to avoid the company of those who have bad habits. It rubs off. Good habits or bad habits, they rub off on us. So we should associate with those who have good habits. Okay? Yes.
Hi, Krishna. Manish, do you have any personal doubts about Krishna consciousness?
Do I have any personal doubts about Krishna consciousness? Yes. Why are so many people not accepting it? That is the doubt. That is my doubt. I try to give a philosophical answer to that, but I'm not able to satisfy myself. And this is also the statement that Parikshit Maharaj says in the Srimad Bhagavatam. who is that person who would refuse to accept Krishna consciousness, which is like the ultimate medicine for all ailments and for the ultimate ailment of material existence? And interestingly, now since we've been talking about vegetarianism, he says, who else would not take to it except one who kills animals? Because when you kill animals, you become hard-hearted and you lose your discrimination, your spiritual sense of spiritual discrimination. Right? Okay, another question.
If animal killing is forbidden, then how do we justify killing animals for pleasing deities?
Killing animals for pleasing?
Deities.
Deity. Actually, we don't. We don't do that. And in this day and age, it is forbidden. So we do not sacrifice animals. But these were things that were done in previous ages. And it was not considered killing, even though in a physical sense it was killing, because there were expert priests who chanted mantras perfectly. And the killing of animals was done in order to test the efficacy of those mantras and also of the execution of the particular religious ceremony or sacrifice that was performed. And what would happen was that that animal that was sacrificed would get a fresh birth, a fresh body, and often it would get even a human life. So it would get progressed into a higher birth. So it was actually a big favor to that particular animal. But in this day and age, which is called Kali Yuga, we don't have those kinds of brahmanas and priests. And we don't have that kind of facility with which to do such sacrifices. Therefore, these things are strictly forbidden in this age. Although it is a fact that many people still do it, but it is considered sinful and it is immense cruelty, and it is also the result or it also results in very severe horrific repercussions. So no, in this day and age we don't recommend that at all. Vegetarianism is good. Prasadatarianism is better.
So I think now we've got two final questions because we're running out of time. So just one here.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Yeah. Where is it coming from? Yeah. Your voice.
So, kind of, you know, introducing my question. When I first came to England, one of the statistics that really amazed me was that in a period of 4 years or so, the faith of people were questioned in the city of London. And it basically, the statistics were kind of mind-blowing, to the point where people had, you know, either disclosed whether their religious faith would be either Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, or other, or no faith, meaning atheist. And it, I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was almost doubling or tripling year by year.
What was Dublin?
The number of atheists that were. Okay. And basically, I think people chose other because they didn't really have any guidance. So, in for most of us, I think we all are constituents of the corporate environment. And most of the people that are leading the institutions are of that kind of character. So can you give us some practical advice on how we can, you know, maintain our own faith and belief whilst we are being led by performing what we call our duty in such environments?
Yes, that's very important. We have to be, first of all, firmly rooted in the understanding of the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. And we have to be firmly fixed and convinced of these ideas. And we have to be in strong company of like-minded people so that we will not be shaken. Imagine a tree that has very strong roots going deep into the ground and which has grown to a big size. Even if there's a strong wind or a gale or a typhoon, the tree will still stand strong, upright, because it has strong roots. And having strong roots, it has now grown stout and strong. And it doesn't get felled by strong winds. So, but on the other hand, if there are other plants that haven't grown enough, they have weak roots, then even maybe not such a strong typhoon will just blow it over or uproot it. So similarly, if our convictions and our company is not sufficiently strong, then it is likely that we will also get swept over by the gale and the tornadoes of modern-day materialistic thinking that is sweeping across the world like a tsunami. You see, because materialistic thinking of the modern times is the lowest common denominator. It's the lowest form of thinking. It's the path of least resistance. Because trying to enjoy the pleasures that this world offers is the least difficult thing to do. Because you just naturally do it, because that's the way of this world. Just as water flows from a higher level to a lower level, naturally, the mind of the living entity who has been in this world for lives and lives is naturally attracted to these activities. So when you have a philosophy that says, well, this kind of freedom must be given to everybody to do whatever everyone wants, and any restriction imposed on that freedom is taken as being authoritarianism or backwardness or something of that sort. So there is this misconception. So people are gliding down in terms of the level of consciousness, and they're couching that in very intellectual and liberal terms, as liberalism, as intellectualism, postmodernism, and so many other isms and terms. So we have to be very cautious about these things. We have to be very firmly fixed in the understanding of the principles and practice of Krishna consciousness, which means we must come to the association of devotees very, very regularly and hear with rapt attention the discourses. We must read in our own homes the Srimad Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita, and we can also electronically hear lectures at home. We must participate in the individual and the collective chanting of the Hare Krishna Mahamantra, the names of Lord Krishna. And we must follow the other rules and regulations that are prescribed for devotees. And if we are in the midst of sincere devotees, we will be protected. Even if there's one strong tree, but if that one strong tree is surrounded by many other strong trees, the chances of that tree standing upright despite gales is even stronger. So even though we may individually be strong, but when you're out there in the world all alone and everybody around you subscribes to that lowest common denominator philosophy, it's easy for us to get influenced. And we get carried away by all these modern day ideas. So we have to stick together. And that will make us strong. Spiritually minded people, devotionally minded people must stick together. Srila Prabhupada gave this example, I think it was from Aesop's Fables, if I remember right, where a father calls his son. He had several sons, and they were always quarreling with each other. So the father was naturally concerned. So he gave them a stick, a little stick each, and told them, just slam it against your thigh. And they did that, and the stick broke. And then he bound all the sticks together, many of them, and he tied them up and told each of them, now you try to break it, and they weren't able to break it. Because all the sticks were now collectively together. So they had the collective strength of all of them together. So they did not break. So similarly, if we as devotees stick together, help each other in Krishna consciousness, in our strong moments, in our weak moments, then we will remain strong. And then we will be able to influence in a very positive and sublime way other people who are lost in this world, devoid of any sound philosophy, who are suffering because of the absence of Krishna consciousness, because of the absence of true love and true happiness. Okay, I can go on and on with that. I think we should stop here.
Thank you.
Yes?
So, I think we have a massive round of applause.